This is Griffin Dunn, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Hey, everybody. This is Adam Chartoff, your host to Film Wax Radio. It's Thursday, October 24th, 2019, and this is episode number 582 of the podcast. We have two great segments today. One is a new film by an old friend. This is Ira's fourth visit on the podcast. For those who want to check out the past episodes he has appeared on, you can go to episodes 57, 234, and 445 of the podcast. As recently as 445, he's back to talk about his latest film, and we'll get to that in a second. The other guest is also a repeat visitor. It's filmmaker Whitney Dow, who was on episode 420. He's back to talk about his latest project. It's called The Whiteness Project. It's sort of a documentary slash sociological project, if you will. And it's pretty amazing. And I'm thrilled to have Whitney back on. We recorded the segment up in Camden, Maine on my recent trip up there for that film festival. And we'll be getting to that in a little while as well. But first, we're going to bring on Ira. And for his fourth visit, as well as his leading star of the film, who is none other than the great French actor, or let's just say the great actor, Isabelle Huppert. And I'm so thrilled. I met Isabelle one other time. It was not for the podcast, but I guess I was writing an article or a review of white material, that Claire Denis film, in which she starred some years ago. And so this was nice to finally have another occasion in which to sit down with her and meet her. And you know, what was especially nice is I have with me like a co-host in a way. I mean, he's my guest on the show, Ira is. But he also, you know, it took about, maybe 15 minutes when I got there till we started, and when Isabelle walked in, and Ira and I just caught up, and it was really nice, and it made me that much more comfortable. It would have been fine because Ira's just a warm guy, but I felt all the more comfortable, as I would ideally in any situation like that where we just kind of talked about family and things like that. And as Ira mentions in the podcast, it was interesting to start talking about family because indeed Frankie, the film that we're talking about here, is about family, as described by the press release. Unfolding over the course of a late summer's day in the fabled resort town of Sintra, Portugal, Frankie follows three generations who have gathered for a vacation organized by the family matriarch, Isabelle Huppert. In this family tale setting, husbands and wives, parents and children, friends and lovers, stirred by their romantic impulses, discover the cracks between them, as well as unexpected depth of feeling. Frankie is being released by Sony Pictures Classics and is coming out tomorrow, Friday, October 25th, in theaters in New York, in Los Angeles, and then wider in the weeks to come. So the film, I should also mention, which was co-written by Ira and his ongoing writing partner, Mauricio Zacharias, also stars Brendan Gleeson, Marissa Tomei, Greg Kinnear, and other international actors. Again, it does take place in Portugal. It is a distinctly American and European film at the same time. How do you do that? How do you have such an accomplishment? Well, that's what we're going to talk about right now. I think I covered all my bases. We can start the show right here with a conversation with Ira Sachs and Isabelle Huppert, only on Film Wax Radio.
There's people in the hotel, you know. They can take pictures.
That's okay. I'm very photogenic.
It's a brutal thing she did, getting us all to come here at a time like this.
You're Francois Cremont's husband. I'm a big fan. Wow, you're a lucky man.
Don't go very far.
You know we're all meeting you in the afternoon.
I can't promise.
It's for Frankie!
People seldom say no to Frankie.
She's a star.
I wanted you to come here because I want you to meet my family.
My mother thinks she knows everything. She has all these plans, you know.
She's in a hurry.
Eileen and Paul. Paul and Eileen.
Jesus.
What?
Open it. I've got news for you. Eileen has brought a friend.
We will see.
And people still come here to wash themselves in this miraculous water.
Yeah, they do, because the water is said to cure people of all maladies.
I don't know what after Frankie means. There's no after Frankie for me.
I'm going to ask you both at least to pretend that you accept my fate. For the sake of this trip, for the family.
I want us to have a good time, which for me now means just time together.
Yeah, Ira's one of my favorite guests, and I consider you a friend. Certainly after this conversation,
yeah.
Now you know more about me.
We've been talking
than,
about our family life for, while we were waiting for this. So we've been talking, which I think is a good intro for this film.
That's right. It's all about family. That's for sure. I mentioned to Ira also that I met you once, Isabel, when you were in New York doing press for White Material.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just hold that up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay.
You remember perfectly.
I do. I remember.
It was Claire and, I think it was Claire and you together.
Yeah,
and, you
know. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't doing the podcast then, so now I actually can capture your beautiful voice. And so it's a thrill to meet you again or to see you again. Ira, I have a question for you regarding making a film in Portugal.
Yes.
And one might suspect or guess that you decided to make a film in takes place in Europe with somewhat of a European cast. There's some Americans too, but because maybe you got financed by Europe or something like that. But in fact, that's not the case. You had this story for quite a while, right?
Yeah. It's funny that people would think that. It would be hard to...
it had something that started off.
No, I understand. All. But I had an idea about making a film about a family on a vacation.
Okay.
And once I had that construct or that narrative framework, then it was, where are we going to go? And my co-writer, Mauricio Zacharias, is Brazilian. His mother's family is Portuguese. And he had recommended that we consider Sintra. So that's how we ended up in Portugal. And I felt like people don't, at least in this country, they don't come with a lot of preconceived ideas of Portugal.
That's true. You know, we're much more familiar with France, for instance, or
yes,
Italy, et cetera.
Yes, yes.
Portugal is sort of... But Sintra, does it? Sintra play itself?
Sintra plays itself.
Right. It does.
Yes, though I would say my Sintra and the Sintra that you might encounter if you got off a bus as a tourist would be somewhat different. Sintra is a big region. It's an area. So there were very particular locations that when I visited, I felt a visceral connection to emotionally that I felt would be right for the film. So I ended up writing with Mauricio. We wrote for these very particular locations in the film.
Mm-hmm. And then, Isabel, you play Frankie, the titular character. Were you familiar with Iris films? Or did you... Where they brought your attention?
I'm familiar with some of his films. I haven't seen all Iris films. I've seen Love is Strange, and I've seen Brooklyn Village, which was a little man here. Mm-hmm. It was called...
What was it called?
Brooklyn Village.
Oh, it was called Brooklyn Village.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's smart.
Yeah.
Brooklyn holds a certain...
it worked.
Mystique, maybe.
Yeah, it worked.
Maybe should have called it that in retrospect, in hindsight.
So these are the two movies I've seen, and ever since I saw them, I thought, we should get together.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was struck by the subtlety, by the writing, the dialogues, the feeling of thing being so truthful, so real. It's not realistic. Nothing to do with realism, because I don't think that in general movies are particularly realistic.
No,
it's always a shape, or it's always a form, let's say. But within this form, I thought, yes, there was something so real and so possible mm-hmm. for the actor to accomplish what I think acting should be always accomplishing, which is taking whatever you do from the notion of a character to the notion of a person. And certainly the way Ira do things, it necessarily takes the actors to a very personal territory, which at the end you feel like it's almost a little documentary about the actors.
You do have something of a, I don't know why I should say this, but this is only meant as an observation, that you kind of do have, Ira, a bit of a, what we might call European sensibility, because the focus has been largely on families, and there is no, it's not quite so plot-centered. Maybe a couple of your earlier films.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm interested in intimacy. That's and I good. Think cinema is a really good place to make a record of intimate moments and to create an intimacy with the audience. And I think in terms of European cinema, it's certainly been a very big part of my education as a filmmaker. I didn't go to film school, and I learned how to make films by watching. And there's a history, and particularly French cinema with a few other people on the outside. But French cinema has been very important to me.
And myself, too. Why is it that so many French films take place on vacation, historically? Maybe less so now.
Yes, we have some famous American films which also take place in vacation, like Vacances Romaines, you know, for instance.
Roman Holiday,
for instance, just to quote one. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think
a voyage. Do
you mean that's why we French people are very lazy? That's what you might mean.
Well, if that's the case, and I'm not saying it is, you prove the contrary, because I don't know when you rest, but you seem to, of course, work all the time.
I rest when I work. For me, it's like I was dreaming alive, but it's really a rest for me. Mm-hmm. You know? No, I mean it. It's not a joke. I really rest when I work. When I don't work, a little less.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Huh. What are you doing between projects?
When I don't work? So many things that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
See plays. I love to go to the theater.
Yeah.
I could go to the theater every evening. That's what I do while I'm here in New York.
Are you seeing plays this week at all?
We've seen Rose Tattoo. The Rose Tattoo last night. Yes, with great Marisa Tomei in it. She's
your
fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
she's really great. And tonight I'll be seeing a play by Florian Zeller, you know, with whom I did The Mother last winter mm-hmm. here in New York at the Atlantic Theater, and it's called The Hate of the Storm with Jonathan Pryce and Ilan Atkins.
Oh my gosh.
At the Manhattan Theater Club.
What a great cast. Yeah. Sorry, I'm getting distracted. I'm always in a note to self. You know, and is there a lot of great theater in Paris?
Oh, yes, a lot, sure. Mm-hmm. And yes, a lot of companies from everywhere, which is nice. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was the set like, given the subject matter? It's kind of a... Let me rephrase... Well, did you guys have time to rehearse? I'm sure the budget didn't allow for a long period per se, but was there time to? Because it was so much about relationships and communication. The film.
Well,
Frankie,
I'm sure Ira has a lot to say about that, but I would say immediately we had time not to rehearse.
I never think of the budget as a restriction for me, even though there are restrictions that come from the budget.
I regret saying the B word right from
No. I just, but I by intention, I don't rehearse before I start shooting. So it's never an issue of time. It's really an issue of strategy and how to get what is the most emotionally alive performances possible. So I tend to spend a lot of work trying to prepare the set, so that the actor has everything that they need, not to have to imagine anything, so that it's all right in front of them. So, for example, in the scene where Isabelle Huppert, Frankie, wanders into a birthday party of an older 86-year-old Portuguese woman, I spent a lot of time before she got there getting that group together, which is a real family.
It's quite clear. Well, other than that, or you are even more brilliant than I take.
No, the brilliant part is actually just getting the family. It's not that I would make a fake version of the family, because you actually can't fake intimacy. Something has to happen real. And I think so for me, and this is often true, that there's often a scene or two in my movie where the fiction fully interacts with a documentary moment. And what I find is that when you have that in a film, it resonates beyond the scene itself. So everything else takes on a feeling of authenticity. So I think for me, I will say, I think we had a pretty, we didn't have a tiny crew, but we had a small crew. It was a very, kind of, there was a friendly, creative, let's put on a show atmosphere to each day. The shooting style is quite technical in some ways, not for the actor maybe, but in terms of the blocking, it was quite specific. Yeah. And I would say that was one of the challenges, was like working in a way that needed to be very naturalistic, but involved a lot of particular moments and choices around lines.
Yeah, a lot of this also takes place outdoors, right? Many scenes are outdoors, some in the rain. You couldn't have obviously waited for rain.
A lot of what you're doing is trying to accept what comes. Sintra is a microclimate that changes basically every hour, from cold to hot to rainy to clear to fog to. And we also had a lot of natural disasters. We had a hurricane, a forest fire, a bunch of things happened.
Did you shoot Frankie or Apocalypse Now?
Every film set, I always feel like whenever I'm on a film set, I'm often thinking about, pretty much every single day, I'm thinking about François Truffaut's La Nuit Américaine, Day for Night, the film about his film set, because something about the humor that he sees in this idea of a bunch of people trying to create something artificially in the real world comes to play every day. There's always something that seems, you know, whether it just be like suddenly you've built something and you're in the middle of the woods and there's someone chopping a tree right next to you. And there's always something like that on a daily basis. And I think for me, I try to accept as best I can. Why not?
Was Isabel one of the first people you cast in this film?
Isabel and I had met after she saw Love is Strange, and we started talking together, and I had this idea to make a film about a family on vacation, and I realized that would be a really wonderful project to work with Isabel on. We would both be, in a good way, fish out of water. We'd both be somewhere different than our home, and I felt that we could discover new things. So Mauricio Zacharias, my co-writer, and I wrote the film with and for Isabella, and then she agreed to do it.
So the script arrived with a letter kind of thing? Or
No, the script arrived. the letter had been before. I mean, okay. I didn't know. I had no idea what it was going to be about. I just knew that, am I right? Yes.
You didn't know.
Didn't tell me anything about, you know, and so I found when I read the script that she was, oh my God, phone is ringing.
I don't pretend that I'm.
That she was an actress and that she was ill. But all of that, you know, if you say that, like this, you know, an actress ill, immediately a number of images come, you know, connected to that, to informations. And in fact, the way Ira treats these two themes, which are the main columns, you know, of the role, you know, actress and ill, in such a way that it doesn't look like anything that you can anticipate, or it's so different. It avoids all the cliches about illness, about being an actress, so it makes the whole thing very, very original, very fresh, very new, very singular.
That's true.
You know what I mean?
I do. I think so, I agree with you.
And immediately when you wrote when you read the script, you could immediately feel, you know, yes, okay, I'm an actress, and so forth, and so what? You know, yeah. I'm an actress, but you know, it's.
The most attention to that was that scene with Greg Kinnear, actually, where he kind of gets you alone in the.
In the park, in this little pavilion.
Pavilion or something. It was a nice scene.
Yeah, that's a really nice scene. It's a very, very It's the perfect example. I think each scene are the perfect example of Ira's touch, but that scene maybe in particular, because you can take the scene is incredibly funny, but incredibly cruel, incredibly sharp, incredibly honest, incredibly, it's a whole philosophy of life also. She in two lines, you know, she says about what she thinks one would expect from each other, you know. Mm-hmm. And I mean, in just a few lines, it's so much loaded, and so, and it's really, it leaves you like, I leave him, you know. how you said,
jaw dropped.
Yes.
But I think, to me, what I think about, because I remember the moment when we shot it, and that's two things. One, that's an example of where that was written to be a walking and talking in the sun scene, and then it started raining and we ended up inside, and that's a great accident. And the other thing is, you're talking about what the lines or what that I might give you as a, in terms of the script. But really what I think about is what the actors gave me in terms of what they were able to do and the complexity and the layers that they were able to generate from the words, that the words are just the base. And there's so many sentences. If I was writing a novel, whole sentences would be written about expression, emotion, a pause, all these things that are not in the script. So it's a mutual experience.
I know you
grew made it
up
much funnier than I would have. I mean, you made it funnier without making it funny, right?
He has that.
That's those, our goal. Yeah.
No, it, interestingly, you mentioned that because it's one of the things that I think Ira guarded us from or warned us not to. The scene is really funny, so we had it wasn't necessary to be more funny that it is funny.
It was,
I mean, the mere fact when I say, oh, you're the man, you know, it says everything. Oh, okay. It can be the beginning of the scene, but it can be the end of the scene. Okay, you are the man. I don't even know to, you know, of course, luckily we have the scene, but I mean, everything is said in one. So it wasn't necessary to say, oh, you are the man, you know, nothing to please the audience, you know, just something much more natural and much more dry in a way. And it was necessary. It was not necessary to do anything else.
I just took our kids to see His Girl Friday. And I'm curious when I think about screwball comedy, whether or not the goal is to play the lines or play the comedy. Because there's such brilliant comic performances of Rosalind and Russell and, I mean, all the small performances, and but it's interesting. Like, are they what were their directions? And
is it George Cukor, that film? That was Howard Hawks.
It's Howard Hawks.
Howard Hawks.
Yeah,
the two bookends of that whole genre, or the two pillars. Or,
yeah,
really. Yeah. Hmm. You grew up, Isabel, with your mom was an English teacher, was she not?
Yes, so did you grow way up before I was born.
I didn't know how often you got the opportunity to speak. I was thinking through how many of your films I've seen, and don't remember you speaking English too often. But it was that an extra, you know, dimension to trying to be acting and speaking English and thinking in English.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I've been so many times here, and
yes,
I've done some English speaking movies, and I've done some stage work in English.
Oh,
also.
I didn't know.
Finally, I speak a little bit of English.
It could open up a whole new.
But sorry. I think there is something different about someone. You know, I've worked in Vietnamese, I've worked in Danish, I've worked in Russian, I've worked in Spanish. So I've worked in a lot of languages, and I do feel that when an actor, and in life, not just an actor, when a person is speaking in their native tongue, a different part of them comes out. Mm. And I really feel that in the scene with Jeremy, and Isabel. Right. It's just there's something which is, and in a way, what it does is it says that this is your primal relationship, prime relationship between you and your son. It seems so much more essential to some extent than you and Brendan Gleeson in the movie. Like it's got more history.
Yes, I keep saying, you know, you are a slightly different person. I say the same, you know, when you speak a different language, which is not your mother tongue language. And it was really nice in this film, interesting, because I speak, you know, because of the composition of the family, English, French, American. So I would speak I would shift quite naturally between from French to the English, and rarely in the same film you have this possibility to be an English speaking person, which means a slightly different person from what you are, and as I quite rightly said, you know, a different person when you speak your own language.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and in a way, I think that there is something, maybe when I speak French, in all those scenes where I speak French, there is something more, a bit, I don't know, more, I wouldn't say harder, but something maybe a little sharper.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah.
Frankie, who's Francois is your character's name, right? So there's a nickname. And you're, maybe it was bestowed upon you by Brendan Gleeson's character, right? Who knows who gave you that name, but I can sort of hear him saying that. Does he call her Frankie in the film, Brendan?
Yes, he calls her Frankie.
He does.
Actually, Michelle calls you Frankie in the film, her ex-husband.
Yes, my ex-husband.
I can't remember him using her name in the film to some extent.
It's such an unusual choice for the title.
Oh, yeah. Well, to me, it's a film about presence and absence, and that there is something about the character which has certainly drawn everyone together. And I really feel like her, she towers over scenes in an affectionate way, even when she's not there.
That's kind of true.
She's the glue.
That's true. And the name, giving it the name, starts it off with you knowing that, or giving you the suggestion of such a thing.
Yes. It's also, to me, it's kind of a novel. It's like a novelistic title. It's like there is a central character.
Oh, right.
And then there's lots of tangents.
That's a really good point, because it does feel like there's something novelistic about this particular film. And, you know, it's not all about so plot oriented as it is character and moments. Well,
But I actually think people say it's not plot oriented because the plot feels quite fluid, because there's actually a lot of plot in the movie.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot of things that happen in the movie. A boy meets a girl.
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No.
But maybe you know what I mean. The arc.
Yes.
You know, which American films are so used to leaning against. You know.
Yes.
Waiting to break the news that someone has cancer, or it would all be about that moment, as opposed to, it seems like people are talking around it in a more in this film.
Well, you're making me think about, we talked about vacation films and a film like Voyage to Italy, which I think is maybe my favorite vacation film. Rossellini with Ingrid Bergman and George Sanders.
Oh, wow.
You've never seen it?
I have not seen that I'm embarrassed to say, but I will.
It's a good. Yeah. I mean, the thing about it is, it's a film in which it's an associative film, and it's an abstract film, and I think that that's the specific tradition of European cinema that's hard to find in America. Is the abstract that seems to be really not the history here.
The I guess my favorite was always the Antonioni. With now I'm going to forget the first of his the sort of the trilogy with
Il Note?
Before that one, the first one where the Monica Vitti, I think
La Ventura. Yeah, yeah.
I'll have to edit that so I don't make
We're all scrambling.
By the way, I wanted to mention, you know, you may not remember this, but I was actually in Love is Strange.
Yes, he was one of the extras in the film.
Oh. I was told I was a principal.
No, that was someone told you falsely.
Okay, well, that might explain why I haven't seen any checks. Well, I was in two scenes, but I'm one of the last people seen on this. Walking across the street at the very end. I don't know if it's. I have to watch it again. Anyway, I thought, you know, you don't look as impressed as I was hoping. Just kidding. Anyway, it was really. Let's repeat that. Frankie is opening here in New York. Anywhere else?
And Los Angeles on the 25th, and then around the country in the weeks after.
Opening wider in the coming weeks. Where is it playing in New York, by the way?
At the Angelica.
Very
and
good.
At the Landmark at 57th Street.
Okay, right. Very good. I hope people go check it out. And I want to say a very moving moment was this final way you closed the film, which stands out in my memory very, very much, where you have this long shot down at the edge of the Is it a cliff?
Yeah, it's a cliff.
It is a cliff, right? Overlooking
yeah.
the ocean.
Yeah.
And one by, like in pairs, your actors, I think that was just, how did you come, I have to ask you how you came up with that. Because
you know,
so,
I think the landscape often told me how to shoot it. And I think I spent so much time in that very location. I visited, went back maybe 20, 25 times. And sometime at a moment I was up on a hill looking down and I saw the crew in a distance. And it was really this one vantage point. I took a picture on my phone and it just, that image of the actor is almost on the moon. The actor on a set, the actor as a character in the distance in a landscape that was bigger than them was something that was very powerful to me.
But I also think of it in a smaller way, like just families, you know, they pair when you have reunions and stuff. It's interesting how people pair off.
Well, it's about a 4-minute shot that I feel that everyone who watches can interpret
the way they want.
The way they want to.
And the way they will.
But by the time you get to that shot, they have enough information to do that in a personal way with the characters. They know the characters. They know the colors of the clothes they're wearing. They know who their history, at least some imagined version of their history. And so I think that there is a pleasure of letting your mind roam with those characters.
Well, I don't know if every filmmaker, director of fiction is quite as thoughtful about everything as you are, Ira, because to speak to so many, but you show a way into the mind of a filmmaker really in a special way. And I think that's why I like talking to you.
Oh, thank you.
I don't come across quite so frequently.
Thank you.
And it's a delight to meet you, Isabel, and to sit and talk with you. And thank you for sharing so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. Whiteness Project is an interactive investigation into how Americans who identify as white or partially white understand and experience their race. Whiteness Project is conducting interviews with people from all walks of life and localities in which they are asked about their relationship to and their understanding of their own whiteness. Each video interview is paired with a statistic that provides a greater societal context and offers an opportunity for self-reflection by the audience on their own thoughts about race. You can go to whitenessproject.org to check out much more information and experience the actual project. And you can also follow them with hashtag whitenessproject. And it's all there on the website if you want to know more. I'm proud to bring on Whitney Dow, who I consider a friend now. This is the beauty part of doing a podcast is people come into your life and you connect with some of them just because you're talking about hefty things, meaningful things, and you connect and you look forward to, you run into them, you look forward, and next thing you know, you're friends. You go on a hike together. What am I talking about? Oh, so we did this conversation you're about to hear up at Camden, Maine, at the Camden International Film Festival, where there was a sort of an interactive portion to it. In addition to screenings, there was a spot where the Whiteness Project was a variation, I should say, of the Whiteness Project took place. And so Whitney was there with his wife, and we all went on a hike one morning because the town of Camden, which is on the sea, but it has outlying foothills, if you will, and it's beautiful. And we went up one morning on to do a nice hike in the woods. And, you know, it's a terrific thing. It was lovely. It was a great thing. And so it's only my pleasure now to present to you my conversation with filmmaker Whitney Dow right here on my show, Film Wax Radio.
No, I remember standing because I was in, I live in downtown Manhattan, and I had a 6-week-old kid, 9/11, and I had two other kids under 4. I think we had like 3 kids in 4 years, so it was kind of crazy.
Oh my god, that is.
And we're sitting there, and
you're here to tell the tale.
Yes, it's not over yet. Until they're like 17 to 21. That's right.
Last you were on, they were all feeding into the college machine. And go ahead.
Yeah, so it's definitely the story's not over. But I remember going out there, and I'd seen that I'd seen my brother called me and said, this plane hit the World Trade Center. I turned on the news, and I went outside. And I looked down Mercer Street, and I could see the buildings. And you could see right away that I didn't think they were going to fall, but you could see that I thought the top was going to fall off, and it was totally torqued. And we're watching it, and this woman behind me starts going, "Fuck those motherfucking Arabs. Fuck those. We have to kill them all. We need to cut." And I started screaming at the top of her lungs. And I was just like, oh, boy, we're in for a ride. I knew right at that moment that where this was going was going to be horrific. And it turned out to be.
Yeah. It just reminds me. It just the people's short-term memory. And the film last night, that was one thing that reminded me of how people I'm referring now to the Filipino people, but that they're forgiving. But I just think it's more about, I don't know what it is.
They're forgetting?
They're more forgetting than forgiving or something, because the level of abuse of power and corruption, I don't know how people still like love this woman, Imelda Marcos, it's just amazing.
Well, I think, it's also... I think so many countries are weirdly, like, they're weirdly aspirational. It's kind of like, why do certain churches, mega churches, give all their pastor all this money? And they, something about seeing their pastor in the mega mansion and the private jet,
yeah,
it allows them to own a piece of it. So it's, I think it's very, it's, I don't think
by
it's
proxy, by osmosis.
Yes. And the other thing I really think about, and I always say it about Americans, but I really think it's kind of a universal thing, is this idea that like humans in general are only interested in effect. They can only process effect. They're really bad at understanding cause and dealing with cause. So they're always like, okay, this outcome, let's deal with it. But like, the cause is building, and it's so clearly that it's building now in this new generation, and they're like almost willfully blind to it when...
So, I guess somewhere in there is the explanation of how all of these folks that are part of the Trump base don't mind that the tax cuts didn't affect them in any positive way, just the really wealthy people. So it boggles my mind. I can never quite wrap my mind around it, I guess. I'm not that sophisticated a thinker.
The reason why the death tax is so popular, which is like, what is it now, $5 million? Like, what fraction of what percent actually has a $5 million estate? But every American is like, that could be me. And I don't want to get the mandate. I think there's a real idea. And, it's like I remember when the New York Lottery ran this ad on the subway system I always loved. It was like, there's someone who won the lottery. Like, I got my American dream at New York Lotto. And it was like, so that's the American dream? The American dream is buying a lottery ticket? I thought the American dream was working hard, and but it's so funny. But I think that is
and building something from nothing. Well, I guess there is an aspect of something from nothing.
But I think it's this idea that like it could happen, like that American idea that like I can be here and I can be at the lowest point, and at some point I can be at the high point.
Right. That is aspirational. Mm-hmm. That idea, and that is the American dream in a sense, right? Essentially, isn't it? For those who. Meet certain criteria anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it fit for everybody. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Last time when we sat down, you were just, I think, in the early, well, obviously you were in the earlier stages of the Whiteness Project, and we talked a little bit about it, but we didn't talk a lot about it. Mm-hmm. And now here we are on the other end of this. And here you are. Is this one of the first opportunities you've had to come to a festival with it? I know it's a variation of the
It's actually, it was what you're seeing here is an iteration of an installation I built for Tribeca 2 years ago.
Oh, is it really?
Okay. Yeah, so It was originally built for Tribeca, but it was an interactive installation that I built for Tribeca.
I see.
And, you know, just to sort of back up a little bit, since we spoke, and I'm trying to remember, what do you remember the date? No.
It's easy to find it out. But easy. Because, hey, Siri.
But for the last couple of years, and was I working with Columbia when I spoke with you at that point?
You know what I should have done is listen to that episode. It's been a while since I've listened to it.
So anyway, what happened is that after the initial two whiteness projects, with the one in Dallas and the one in Buffalo, I ended up partnering with something called the Interdisciplinary Center of Innovation Theory, Innovative Theory and Empirics, which they used the project to create the first large-scale study of whiteness and white Americans by a major research institution. They're part of Columbia University.
Okay.
And so we spent the last couple of years,
August 11th, 2000.
I guess I was probably just starting working with them around that.
2 years ago.
Yeah. So we did three more cities, but the way it would work, rather than me going to the city and casting it and trying to figure out an idea, they would send a team of sociologists into the city who would map the city, collect data on about 500 people in each city with these detailed qualitative and quantitative questionnaires. Then they would take a representational sample of the city, and then I would do these oral histories with them, about 50 in each city.
How many?
About 50 in each city.
15 or 50? 50, 50,
50, 50.
Okay, makes more sense.
And so that became something that's a Columbia University-based website called Facing Whiteness now that's up that people, and it's more of an academic research site. I haven't done anything with the media that's external. You can go see the interviews at it. You can download the transcripts. You can all of them live, and you can ask for copies of the data. And all of it was going to live in the Columbia University library system. So that was the thing that I kind of finished that up last year. And what I'm doing here is sort of, Sean Flynn called me about 6 weeks ago and said, oh, you know, we're really interested in sort of doing something on whiteness. We're thinking a lot about race and power here. You know, can you put something together here for the Camden Film Festival story forums? And he said, it doesn't have to be, just take what you have and just string it together, and I was like, oh yeah, sure, I can do, like, there's always this thing, you're like, oh yeah, no problem, I can just put something together. And then I was thinking I was going to string together the interviews into some sort of order, and of course as soon as I started doing it, I was like, oh, this doesn't work at all. Because one of the things that I think that, you know, that you'd be interested in is this idea of the original whiteness projects, digital pieces. I was really working hard to find a new model of narrative, meaning it's circular. If you remember, you go online, you sort of navigate your way through it. There's no set structure. So you complete the narrative by deciding who you're seeing that you want to follow. And one of the problems of putting it in a linear order is I decide who you're seeing saying what. And so it's much less me saying, okay, this is an idea, and I'm going to try to show you facets of this idea that are based in both the quantitative and qualitative world, and saying, okay, now Whitney Dow is going to put together a conversation for you to listen to based on his experiences with these people. So it became... And you've seen the piece, it was sort of it's the first time I've ever done anything linear with, after 350 interviews or whatever I've done, to even attempt to put something together that is actually has some sort of narrative flow and arc.
Hmm. Yeah. And I was wondering why, unless people have a more nuanced understanding of the intention behind it, this doesn't show it. But it's still, I mean, captivating, and the subjects that are your talking heads, are captivating. They're all these really thoughtful and articulate young folks. And, you know, you may find some of their ideas kind of repugnant or unfortunate, but you can't deny that they're not thoughtful. They clearly have processed these thoughts of theirs, and they're talking about them in mostly seemingly honest ways. So, you know, that has an impact. I'm wondering why it was in the context of story forms, because it is linear and it's like watching a documentary or something in that way, you know?
Yeah, I think that one of the things they did is that the America, the companion piece that's there
across from your screen that yours is playing on.
Yes, so there's two things.
They're supposed to interact.
Two films.
Okay.
Yeah, and the idea I think that Sean and Scott had when they were putting it together was sort of to create some sort of a dialogue.
Yes, and I see it. I could see it, and you know. Your wife, right? She intentionally put on.
She couldn't figure it out. She was like, but it started happening. Yeah, she watched America and used the Whiteness Project as a sound. And she said it was suddenly fascinating to listen to these white voices while watching images of blackness created by a black artist.
Jatobia? Was that?
No, that's not Chitovia.
That's
it's,
she's doing something different. Okay.
Garrett.
Garrett Bradley.
Garrett Bradley, I'm sorry.
Is it Bradley?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
I think so.
I have to. I want to just double check.
So for those, you know, as this is a podcast, there's a small room. There's two large screens facing each other, one that has the Whiteness Project running on a loop and one that has Garrett's, we're hoping it's Bradley's, America running on the other side, and there's sets of wireless headphones, and there's two channels. You can pick either one to listen to, and most people watch one and then the other. They sort of watch in order, but that's sort of. And what's interesting about it is that it's sort of two very different representations of race. One is actuality, meaning it's
yes,
is it. It's one is actuality, and mine obviously processed through a filmmaker, but the other is a narrative vision of black representation in cinema,
right?
And sort of in dialogue with whiteness and in dialogue with sort of trying to break out of the of sort of the constraints that the white vision puts on blackness, black representation. So I really loved the piece. I really loved the America piece, and I thought it was really. But again, I had no idea how they were going to present them, and so I considered as much this linear piece as much an experiment as anything else.
Yeah, have you heard from people the reactions?
I haven't. I went down. I haven't really talked to anybody about it. I mean, I've heard who's seen it. So you're the first person.
Okay.
So you can tell me what you think.
I mean, a little bit.
The question I had for you then is that when you say, you know, there's nothing that states an intention, do you feel like it can be misinterpreted, or do you feel like it's open for interpretation by people who are coming to it?
Well, I think you're going to get very profoundly different responses from different people who come from different experiences. Mm-hmm. That's the... Mm-hmm. That's the beauty of it. So it would be really interesting to have a panel, you know, or a Q&A in response to that could be quite intense, actually, because some of the subjects are, you know, they have very
racist
views, and some of them have racist views and then are thoughtful about that and maybe a little bit ambivalent about these knee-jerk or instinctual ideas that they grew up with, you know, and then some of them reject them outright. It's the whole spectrum of personalities,
and that's really the idea.
Representative
that it's trying to sort of hold up a mirror, and I think in general,
it doesn't really. And there's no way is anybody being judged. You know, they're just talking,
and that's you know, that's really by intention. Is I feel that it's not. I'm really glad that you said that, because one of the things I was concerned about in it is that, you know, you place somebody next to somebody else and you process them one way. And I really don't, I have my own opinions. I judge people personally, But I don't want, I say everybody who comes and does the Whiteness Project, I say, look, I'm not going to guarantee you're going to like it, but I want to be, I'm going to accurately represent you. I'm going to accurately represent my experience with you and your view, so that it's really important to me that if someone's going to come up and be really honest, that's all I'm asking. I'm really just trying to hold up a mirror.
It's crucial.
Yeah. And I think that what I like to see is that, and what I've heard from a lot of people, is they see, some see themselves, but some see family members, some see different parts. And so it allows people to, by proxy, process some of these really complicated ideas without saying, by seeing somebody who reflects somebody they're close to, or even something, and I would even argue that even some of the most reprehensible things that are said, we as white people all hold pieces of that inside of us. I think that you can be anti-racist, you can be for social justice, but that doesn't stop you from having racist thoughts, and it doesn't stop you from, it's for the same way that you can be, you know, pro Me Too and women. I have three daughters. That doesn't stop me from having sexist thoughts. That's
right.
That for the any way that, like, you know, I'd like to be, you know, 5 pounds lighter. That doesn't stop me from eating something. But I go to the gym, right? It's like, so it's the. So that's really was sort of the intention of. So I'm glad, but we'll see. I will see. I'm going to be doing a talk with DeJovia on Saturday.
Right.
And so we'll see what I hopefully in that talk, what I really, really always hope is that somebody somewhere has a negative reaction to what I'm doing, so they can put it out in the open. The worst thing is when people are unhappy and they don't speak up, then so it can be aired.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see.
Well, I also think it's really important, especially now more than ever, we should really embrace the opportunity to hear people's thoughts, no matter how, again, I use the word repugnant, you know, and it is in some cases, but it's so important to hear these people out and let them express their feelings in the context of the most harmless, you know what I mean? They're just speaking. And they're not using epithets. They're not using, you know. So it's important to hear them out. Squelching those people, I think, is what is more probably damaging. I think we need to hear them out, and then we need to have a place where, hopefully, people can reason with. You know, I mean, I don't think obviously your project. I assume that there's no follow up or anything. That you just want their thoughts at that particular moment in time, and then.
Well, no, actually, I mean, I was hoping to do a lot more follow-up. The real process, you can imagine this has been a challenge to raise money for. This project has always been, it's been by far the most widely seen, processed, you know.
Sure.
The website still gets, you know, tens of thousands of visits every month. But it's, and it's been seen in every country, millions and millions of views. It's been the hardest thing to raise money for I've ever done. It's that, and understandably so. I think that the, you know, people understand.
Controversial?
It's just, you know.
Or it doesn't offer solutions. And maybe that's what, you know, they want. I mean,
Maybe you're right. But I actually, I did have a whole proposal and project that with a funder that remained nameless that I went down to, that actually put it in, that built an entire engagement and educational program around it.
Right.
But they finally came and said, you know, we just, our board doesn't want our name on something called the Whiteness Project.
I see. Yeah.
I've tried to change. Look, it used to be called For Whites Only. So it's now it's for, and now for
you,
Columbia,
you could,
I changed.
Why don't you use that rationale and try?
Yes. Now at Columbia, they changed it to Facing Whiteness. So it's moving towards prescriptive.
Right.
Whiteness Project is kind of, you know, it's kind of a, what do you call it, a squinting modifier.
It's hard to reconcile what that could mean in an abstract way, or in a without the context of knowing the project itself and what.
Well, it's funny because, you know, Stanley Nelson.
He
was always giving me shit about it. He's like, you're standing behind the work, not in front of it. You need to get out in front of it, and you're not. You're like, he accused me of being a coward. You know, he's like, you got to get out in front of it because you're the only one who's had this experience now. With 300, talking to 350 people about this, you have a deep well of understanding experience, and you're kind of relying on your subjects to try and process it, which it's a sophisticated way to do it, but it's maybe not the cleanest way to communicate things.
Mm. What do you think?
Well, you know, I would, you know, I would be very open to doing something that's where something where I'm more in front. I have to really figure out how, what it would look like and what it would be. Again, it's, when I originally conceived of this thing, I conceived it as a linear film with a lot of animation and sort of like, you know, sort of Schoolhouse Rock type animations that sort of explain a lot of these conceptual ideas. I've gone down so many different blind alleys, and again, it's just the, you know.
It just hasn't occurred to you yet, or you haven't figured this out yet.
I haven't
yet.
Figured out, because I've sort of been going down this road, and I do a lot of other work, and this is kind of, because it's not been hugely funded, I funded other ways. I did 130 interviews last year for $20,000. So that, I put money that I make doing advertising, money that I make doing, you know, commission stuff, and... Mm-hmm. You know, I teach, I do a lot of things, and this is sort of, it's sort of something, it's been a labor of love. It's not to say I've raised a few hundred thousand dollars for it, but in the context of doing 350 interviews and installations and all this stuff, that's over 7 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not as much money.
Yes, it sounds like a lot of money if you're sitting, but it's been To be in towns for 6 weeks as we were in state, it's hugely expensive to do. Yeah,
right, yeah, but it does pale in compared to sending four daughters through college in this country.
Yeah. Yeah,
I'm surprised you didn't all pick up and move to Canada.
Camden? Well, just
or
I think we
Camden.
Should,
no, I was thinking a little further north.
I think we should. Well, one thing we should stop just notice is that this is the
yeah
that
oh,
we
yeah.
are doing this we podcast on a bench looking out over beautiful Camden Harbor.
Yes.
On the most crystal clear, beautiful day.
I didn't
day.
Notice until just now that you mentioned it. And there's... Hi, how are you guys? Some locals walking by who seem completely unfazed. You'd think they were New Yorkers. Mm-hmm. I was at one festival in Columbia, Missouri, so maybe you know which one.
True, false.
That's
true,
correct. I was in a coffee shop or a restaurant or something like that at one point, and I actually did something very different. I interviewed some of the locals mm-hmm. because that was one of these festivals where... It was so populated by community, which is true with many smaller festivals.
Traverse City is another one,
I just came back from.
Love that festival.
That was a wonderful festival.
I love that festival, yeah.
It really is great.
Yeah, right? I would say, like, what my favorite thing about that, you know, I shouldn't be on a talking about Camden, I should be talking about another festival, but they have every...
They're not overlapping, and they do very different...
Every one of your screenings, because I've had films there... is sponsored by a different local business. So it's they're sponsored by the local gym, the pharmacist, the restaurant, and the owner of the business who's chosen to sponsor introduces your film. So you go in, and so the person, you know, might own that. This
are this at Travers?
At Travers.
I don't think so. But
That's when I was there. Oh, I was there.
I don't know if that happens.
5 years ago.
Okay.
And that was the last time I was there was 5 years ago. That was the case. So like
it was a very young festival 5 years ago.
Yeah, it's exploded. I'm sure.
Yeah, but it doesn't feel like that.
Because it's not a market.
Well, that's right. Yeah. And also, the festival is not as spread out, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I have that some festivals are so spread out, it makes it difficult to make it to things. And then, you know, if you don't have a vehicle with you, you know? Anyway. But yes, it's a special festival, and I had a wonderful time. I'd love to go back every year if I could, but I don't think that's going to... Sorry, they invited me this year. They brought me, so
yeah.
which is very,
That's
very,
really
very nice. Thoughtful. But it turned out that there was a change of I don't know if you know, but they had a change of staff.
Yeah, so it's just not Deb Lake anymore. And
no,
yeah,
no. So and the publicist and the couple of the his you know producers are working with.
Yeah.
So I didn't see them at all, but they were there apparently. But they all said let's offer to Adam and bring him out. It was very nice. I said, well, can I do some Q&As or can I what can I do? Can I make coffee? I was willing. Yeah, no, just come and experience the festival. And I did, of course, do a bunch of interviews there. But
what I love about the festival too is it's one of the few festivals where I feel that the narrative and documentary is really integrated. The community, you really mix it up. Where you go to a lot of these festivals, it's like, it's, you know, town and gown or or Hufflepuff and Slytherin. You know, I'm not sure, but you really in that festival. You're so always together.
That's right.
Whether it's swimming in the lake at midnight or like going to, it's really a fun.
Yes, festival. They make it fun. It's a fun festival. They do a lot of fun things there. Most of the main venues are pretty close, which I also again I really appreciate. How many times have you been to Camden?
This is my first time.
Oh, it is.
Yeah,
I think you told me that yesterday. Yeah. Maybe you told me that. Really, an incredible setting.
You know, it's unbelievable. And the other thing,
anything like they could top Lake Michigan, but I may be wrong.
The swimming is not quite as pleasant, though. It's a little chilly. I think the water is probably like 50 degrees compared to like Lake Michigan.
Yeah, we were there kind of like at the warmest point.
The warmest point, yeah. So, yeah. So, but other than that, this is really pretty spectacular. Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing I wanted to say is that I wanted to mention, I think it's interesting. Part of the process of me being at here at Camden is that Sean and Meg from something called the Waterfall Arts Gallery in Belfast, they commissioned me to do a Maine-based whiteness project. So for the last few days, I've been shooting interviews.
Belfast, Maine?
Yes.
Okay.
Belfast, Maine. So the last few days, I've been shooting interviews in Rockland.
Oh, yes. You mentioned that, too.
Yeah. So which has been really, really interesting because, you know, it is, I think Maine is somewhere between just over 95% white and just under 95% white. It's the whitest state in the union, so
it is.
Where else to better to do the whiteness project than Maine?
The white state.
The white state. So,
yeah. So tell me about those subjects that you talked to since it's so fresh. Are they?
Yeah, it's. I mean, it was interesting, and I think that one of the biggest challenges of the project in general every time we land is to get a representational sample of people is really tough because the people who come to it, you have to figure out ways for them to come. So one of the struggles with the project has always been is I tend to get more liberal than conservative people.
Of course.
Yes.
Right.
So, but we got a pretty good range of people. We're trying to turn around in a couple of weeks. So the actual exercise of cutting this other thing has been helpful because I think we have something, you know, like, 20 hours of footage now that we're trying to get it up by the end of this month. And that takes, 20 hours footage takes 40 hours to watch before you even start cutting. So,
what are you doing?
Because you're analyzing it, obviously. Yes, you're making notes and everything.
But you're making notes and you're pre-editing.
Pre-editing, making selects and everything.
Right.
So I think it's going to be a similar piece to what's here, but probably a lot longer.
The folks that, for instance, that you were interviewing, all of them? In Belfast, Maine?
No, I interviewed them in Rockland.
Rockland, Maine.
They're
from Belfast, but
the gallery is in Belfast. That's going to go in.
I see. I stand corrected. but these people that you interviewed this week, they're not shaded by informed by
the previous iterations?
Other iterations? Have they? Some are. Discourage that?
No, I try and be as transparent as possible.
Okay.
And I say,
I mean, I can see it'd be helpful for people that maybe are nervous about speaking their truth. That they could see that other people have done it and they're not somehow lionized or become pariahs or.
Yeah, I don't. No, I think it's actually, I say, Google me, Google the progress, look at it. Mm-hmm. And I also have a process where I say don't sign the release till we finish the interview.
Oh.
And even when I was doing the Columbia, I don't have time now because of the time frame. But I would do the interview, send them a transcript. I say run a line through anything you don't want me to use. I'm not.
You're not trying to catch.
I'm not trying to catch anybody out.
Right.
I'm not trying to I really want to reflect them accurately, and I want them to feel reflected accurately. And I think for a lot of people, I mean, look. You and I have platforms. We get to say what we want in different ways. I mean, what a gift to be able to, like, talk to the world the way you talk to the world, be able to talk to the world the way I do. And most people don't have that platform. And so, eventually, it's a platform where they can come. And especially if they're people that don't have, not, I would say agency in the world, but don't necessarily have that much influence, to sort of have a way to speak. And I actually feel that, like, the actual, what's the project is not just the media that you see. I really consider the interviews themselves as part of the project and the experience that the people have. And I would say that 20 to 30% of people that I interview have some sort of a transformational experience during the interview. It's very, people never talk about this stuff. And it's really a way to talk about something. And at this point, I'm very experienced with eliciting honest comments from people in a way that's, and again, because they don't have to sign the release, it's sort of a low risk way of doing it. And the way, it's done with an iDirect, it's done in this very, very specific way that I do it.
Explain what that is.
I just, I have
an iDirect.
An iDirect is a box that goes on a tripod that you put the camera in that has two mirrors in it that essentially puts my face. It's kind of like
a
an Teratron.
But it's Errol Morse's
invention. It's an analog Teratron, so that the problem with the Teratron is that your face, you have a camera in your face that puts your face on a teleprompter, so they can look into your eyes. But to look into their eyes, you have to look at the camera lens. And so you're actually not making eye contact. With iDirect, there's a one-way mirror that the camera shoots through and another mirror. So it's actually you're looking right into their eyes. And you maintain eye contact with them throughout the entire interview. But the viewer feels that they're talking right down the lens of the camera.
Right, because people are accustomed to similar types of interviewees looking off camera.
Yes.
Right.
In the way,
or they're looking into the camera, but it's very uncomfortable for people to look into a camera and talk openly.
Yes, so this makes it really, right. Yeah, really easy. And the other thing, and I guess a question for you is seeing the thing blown up. One of the issues that I've blown up when I see it blown up is that it was designed originally for a computer, so the framing is designed so it feels like a mirror, like kind of how you see yourself when you're looking at a computer screen. You kind of see yourself sort of chest up. And so that's the way I shoot them, so it actually feels like you're...
How would you shoot it differently if you knew it for a much bigger screen?
I experimented shooting it much wider.
I see.
And so you'd see more body language and more just, comfort. But it's, I'm not sure it's better.
None of this occurred to me.
Yeah.
I don't, as far as my own personality goes, I tend to get very... sucked into that type of, storytelling, that type of interview, and I'm it becomes like an emotional experience immediately, where I want to connect with that person and what they're saying, and so I feel angry, I feel sad, I feel empathetic about very easily, I'm very vulnerable like that, I guess. So I don't really, I almost just don't even think about it from a technical standpoint when I'm watching something like that myself. I mean,
you're the dream audience for a filmmaker then, because the idea
is
that
I do this, I think.
My feeling is that if you see the technology, then you're not using the technology right. The idea, like film is an emotional medium.
Yeah.
And
it's the power of the camera.
It's not an informational medium. Mm-hmm. And so you want people to have emotional connection, whether it's an image of a beautiful harbor or whether it's someone.
Or Rachel Maddow.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Talking about whatever, maybe not. Mm-hmm. But in the interactive version of this, and people can go to the Whiteness Project.
Whiteness Project.org. Yeah.
And whitenessproject.org. And so you come to a screen with a bunch of different faces.
It's basically a carousel of faces that you can turn.
Okay.
So it's a circle,
right?
And you can see the faces, and they have a face and a.
And then you can spin it.
A little quote. You can spin it. You can pick any way you want to go in. So people pick the people that they sort of see themselves
but
in.
By their face.
And that was sort of
another... interesting if you get to if it stops like a, like a roulette wheel or something, if it stops and then you get the beginning of, as you pass your cursor over it, or at the beginning they're starting to talk.
No. It's a still, and it has a quote over it. So
I see.
The other thing I was really...
I forgot that part of it. As they're speaking, you have... what do you call them? Subtitles?
It's animated subtitles, along their sides and stuff.
Yeah, it moves from side to side, but you can read everything. Why did you choose to do that? Because that takes your eyes off of the subjects.
The reason I did that is that so that because you have to put on the headphones, mm-hmm. not everybody is not necessarily going to come in and make okay. that choice. They can sort of...
Oh, it could be a compelling way to...
You can look at it and see. And the other thing is that it's also for, you know, I have a deaf cousin and okay. I'm very... The first version of it, I was like, put it out without doing subtitles. And I felt terrible. She was so mad. She was like, what the fuck are you doing? And I was like, yeah. you know, I was like...
Right. Well, nah. it's personal.
Yeah, it's personal. I'm like, what the fuck am I doing? So I really, I think that it's important to, okay. you know, to remember mm-hmm. that not everybody's watching your stuff can necessarily hear. So, right.
But usually we have the option of doing that.
Yes, on that, yes. But this was, this particular one was designed for an installation.
As you say, it's animated, so it's not the kind of thing you can disable the...
Yes.
Yeah, I understand. Right. Yeah. Yeah, in fact, you don't want to enable subtitles while the animated styles are going. That actually happens because you have, as you know, like if you're watching certain streaming platforms,
yeah.
you can have the subtitles, you know, like a foreign language film, mm. you'd want to do that. But then there's also for the deaf, they also explain the sounds and other
yes.
things. So yeah. it's a whole different
music.
Sometimes technology yeah. that's an option.
Background
you can have yeah. both playing at the same time sometimes, you know, if you're not yeah. careful. Because sometimes you'll watch something with the subtitles there by default, and yeah. then, anyway. Yeah, right. Subtitles don't typically, they may say something like music, but mm-hmm. more often than not, they don't mm-hmm. talk about like how the wind is mm-hmm. or something. I don't know. Anyway, it's great to see you here. We're going to go for a hike tomorrow, is that the
idea? Yeah, the idea
is. In the foothills of the...
Yeah, and the foothill, supposedly that little mountain over there has an incredible view of the harbor.
Oh, great. Oh, yeah. Of course it would.
Yeah.
Is that a little, can you see as I think it's that the kite, right? To the left of the kite, that's the top of the
tower.
Mountain.
Yes.
It's a little tower over there, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe we should go there. Yeah. I think I could be talked into doing this.
I think you should definitely. I think it's like, you know.
I just don't, are you, how far is that?
I bet this woman knows. Excuse me.
Miss?
What's the name of the mountain?
But.
And
Mount
how,
what?
How long a hike?
Batty?
And what's how long a hike is it to the top?
Like 20 minutes.
Oh, no, but how long? But you have to drive to the there, right?
No, the trailhead is on Spring Street.
Oh, okay.
So it's just a couple blocks
Spring Street.
Away.
Oh. Probably like 4 blocks. And it only takes 20 minutes to walk to the top there? It's a foot.
Well, you look pretty fit. So,
it's
like, yeah, what about some old geezers like us?
We just got dissed. So much for your lobster drinking, cracked, smoking. I'll be here, right?
And that's a World War I memorial at the top.
Oh, really?
I was going to ask, that little tower you mean at the very top?
A little spiral staircase.
Oh, nice.
Okay. That might take us 20 minutes alone.
I'm going to have my binoculars going to be watching you from up there, checking out yours. What's your name?
Janelle?
And the name of your business here is Camden Harbor Cruises, which is open from mid-May to mid-October, 7 days a week for the low, low price of
$29
in New York. Yeah. Can't get lunch for $29 in New
There's
York.
There's lunch included?
No.
No,
I'm trying to make a point about like how you can't get a good lunch in New York City for $29 anymore.
Yeah, well,
I mean, you can.
You have to get the dirty water dog.
Street meat. All right.
Then I guess I know the other thing I wanted to sort of mention to you just while we're
Thank
talking.
Thank you, Janelle.
Is that I would say that, you know, you asked about a linear film. They actually sort of talk a little about the film I'm working on now, which is about reparations. And I'm making a film with a woman called Erica Alexander, who was in Get Out and... Living Single, The Cosby Show, and we're following HB 40, the bill.
Wait, is this a narrative?
No, it's a we're following the trajectory of the reparations bill HB 40
uh-huh.
That Sheila Jackson Lee has introduced into Congress, and we've
okay.
been shooting. We've been
she's
shooting
a rep.
Yeah, she's a rep.
And she is trying to put this through currently.
Yes,
in this current
Congress.
Congress, well, the Congress isn't so much the problem as the
the Senate. Well, Cory Booker is going to sponsor
okay.
in the Senate.
Oh, great!
But the issue is that this is actually a bill that Senator Conyers introduced in 1989 for the first time, and he's introduced it every year until he retired. Never got out of committee, and the bill is to form a committee to discuss reparations and appropriate remedies.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bill to have a discussion
right.
that they can't get a vote on. It's not a bill for reparations. It's a bill to have a discussion about reparations.
I see. And so it's when a he vehicle.
So when he retired, Sheila Jackson Lee took it over, and she's trying to get it.
What's her district?
She's in Texas, and I'm not sure that's as far as I go.
Yeah.
So I've shot. Right now, Eric was shooting down there yesterday with with her.
Erica Alexander, who is an actress, but
she's an actor and
a justice warrior.
A justice warrior. She's
An activist.
She's an activist.
Okay.
And an actress, and she's an incredibly powerful person that I've met. So I'll talk to you more about it as we move down the pike. So
That'd be great, and maybe we can do something with you and Erica. Then.
Yeah, no, you would love her. She's amazing. So I'd love to do that.
Well, that's interesting in respect to the Whiteness Project to then do a project about reparations. So.
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny because I was interested in doing a project on reparations. I've been really interested in the financial story, the financial leads to the moral. And if you start at the moral, it becomes some sort of an indictment as opposed to taking that out of it. If you just look at the full straight up financial ramifications of slavery, how it's embedded in everything, who it's benefited, who it hasn't benefited,
right.
It's much, much easier to understand than say, it's a terrible thing. Well, how do you quantify that? Well, you can quantify financial transactions. And there's an incredible book out that I recommend anybody who's remotely interested in reading called The Half Has Never Been Told by Edward Baptist that sort of links slave narratives to economic developments in the country and how sort of, slavery was really and the cotton trade was the economic powerhouse that really put us on the map and drove the Louisiana Purchase, drove so many things that bank instruments, all kinds of things that makes who we are today.
On the backs of slaves.
On the backs of slaves.
African Americans. And then, at least we built the railroads ourselves. We can take credit for that at least. The unlikelihood of a bill in this day and age of right now that somehow passing through the Senate and all the necessary steps. However, let's say in the abstract and hypothetical it did. So what happens? Do people apply or do they...
That's the question, isn't it?
It is. Like how reparations get...
Well, that's what the bill says is to actually ask that question. Is this something that is viable? How would it be adjudicated? I think that what happens very quickly, people say, it's impossible. You can't write everybody checks. Well, nobody's even saying that at this point. People are just saying that this is an uncompleted part of our history. This is, everybody would say that, it's the original sin or whatever, however they put it. And it's something that hasn't been resolved, really. We've never had any kind of reconciliation. So what does that look like? I mean,
here's an idea.
Yeah.
For instance, what you could do with that money, you could pay off or try to pay off all the inner city liquor store owners to shut down their liquor stores and come up with rehab centers or facilities to help alcoholics. There's an idea.
Well, I think that if I look at some of this interesting model is like the tobacco settlement that created truth.com, where they essentially had to fund the destruction of their own business, right? They had to, like, that whole however many billion dollar fund that was created, where they created all kinds of ad campaigns about how dangerous tobacco was. And I think part of what I think when you talk to a lot of African Americans, one of their issue is like this story has never been told accurately, that what we're forced to endure is this false history being taught in the schools. It was an interesting settlement. There was a police brutality case in Chicago, and I should know exactly what it is, but I don't. But part of the settlement was that they had to put curriculum in the school system about the relationship between police and the black community and the history of police brutality in Chicago, which has been legion. So I think part of it is to say, really tell the story accurately. I think the challenge of that is that you even see there's an interesting article in the Times just the other day about how as plantations, places like Monticello, start telling the story more completely, saying that it's not a simple, happy story. It's a complicated story, as all stories are, that the pushback they're getting from the visitors is like, you know, I came to hear about Jefferson. Why are you talking about slavery? And so I think that, I mean, just saying we're going to tell the history accurately as is a complicated.
It is a complicated. It's a jacket pill. Well, you know, and it's interesting because people want myth.
Yes. So
they're starved for mythology.
Well, I think that one of the problems is that, like, white. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, no.
That whiteness is connected to American exceptionalism. Mm-hmm. And American exceptionalism is connected to this myth of the independent actor. And we are, no one is an independent actor, right?
Yeah.
So I think it, by challenging white supremacy, you're talking about reparations, you're actually challenging, you know, American exceptionalism, which is, well, then you're asking us to come up with a new story about ourselves as white people. And that's a bigger challenge than to say you have to pay for something, to say you have to reimagine your place in the world and understand your righteousness, your righteous narrative in a different way is even more challenging.
Well, we underestimate our young citizens, because there's some young, very young people in your whiteness project who are pretty brave, or not so much brave as they, I don't think they'd consider themselves brave. I think just less afraid of the truth, of saying the truth about being white and our legacy of what we've done in this country, as well as around the planet, you know. And it doesn't mean everybody has to apologize or feel shame. It's just dealing with truth is a liberating thing, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You can't be free without the truth. I just feel that's my feeling.
Well, you've seen the reaction to the 1619 project. Is like some people did backflips over it because. But I think you're right. Is that, you know, someone who's my age, you know, 57. The world I grew up in is so vastly different. Just the language. Like when I grew up, there was no language to discuss race. When I started this project, there was no. You know, I started shooting probably 7-8 years ago. The conversations we're having then are so fundamentally different that we're having now, and that just the same way when I was young, this idea, like gay marriage wasn't even considered a possibility. Mm-hmm. Now, when I go to same sex marriages, my kids aren't like, "Oh, this is incredible." They're like,
"Right,
Dad, your friends are so boring. Do we have to stay?" Like that's like they're not even processing it as something different. When I grew up, gay culture was subculture. Now, gay culture is culture.
Right. Yeah. What's exciting about checking in with filmmakers like you is witnessing the journey you're on also. And we started rather late, like only a couple years ago, documenting. But it's one of the benefits of this and bringing people back on is to see their journey, you know, as storytellers and artists and as human beings, you know. Yeah. So it's wild to see where you're heading, you know. I look forward to...
Well, thank you. If I knew where I was heading, I'm looking forward to knowing where. Yes.
Well, that's the whole thing. You're also on the same sort
path,
of. You don't know where this next thing will, what opportunities will come, or what you know may come of it as a, you know. So, well done.
Well, I appreciate it.
You have
a stack
of scripts on your desk.
Yes.
And you're just trying to get through them all methodically. It's a different journey.
Yes, but it's. I mean, the thing is, as you know, it's also like what the you're also faced with the market, like what. You're like, what's the next film you're going to make? Well, I have 10 films I'd like to make. The next one I make is the one that gets funded. That's like the reality of it.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's always really great talking to you, Adam. I really, you know, it's like, I appreciate what you do. I like talking to you, I like listening to you talk to other people. So it's like,
Thank you. Hope you enjoyed that show. We are going to be back in only a few days with a brand new episode. We have an episode with a couple of filmmakers from documentaries that I've seen lately at Camden and a couple of other spots. And now they're going to be at DocMYC. So we're going to have friend Martha Shane. We're going to have an episode with Michael Apted. We're going to have an episode with the filmmaker Christoph Belson about a documentary called Mother. We have, of course, as I've been putting off forever, my conversation with Lee Grant, the author of a new book on Woodstock. This is one of the few authors who actually experienced Woodstock. Mike Greenblatt will be on the show. We have Tyler Meesom, an old friend, will be making his first appearance on the podcast. Please do take care of yourselves and the ones you love. Until next time. Broken lines, broken strings.